up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Now, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sun down.
Well, Norfolk, Stacks, and Jacks. Time out. Ricardo on the board. S&P futures up 11. NASDAQ futures up 65. So we had a huge bounce back day yesterday. Huge. Almost as bad. Well, actually, probably as bad as or as good as the bad day was earlier in the week. Dow was up 683. S&P up 119. NASDAQ up 464. 2-3% moves every day. Just every day. This is normal, you know. This is cool. Anyway, some of us think it's not all that healthy, but obviously it's healthier on the way up than on the way down. Do we have Professor Kevin?
You do. Good morning.
How are you?
I am doing okay.
I just want to read you a little thing here and ask me if this guy could be on CNBC today. So bear with me. The five terrifying hours of panic established March 26, 1929 is easily the worst crash of the Coolidge-Hoover era and the heaviest day of trading in the history of the New York Stock Exchange, surpassing the previous record by more than 1.2 million. The whole business scared the bejeebers out of Charlie Mitchell, not solely because his National City Company was stuck with 300,000 shares of Anaconda Copper, which he had intended to unload on an unsuspecting public at inflated prices in April. The scheme was ruined, at least temporarily, by Anaconda's plunge from 194 to 142 on that one miserable day. More important, Mitchell was fully aware that any recurrence of panic might cause the bull market to collapse entirely. That, of course, would be very bad for National City, the country's recognized leader in the retail marketplace of security, but also likely set off a chain reaction of corporate and bank failures would send the nation spinning into a full-scale depression. So he reasoned, if investors were selling because they feared the credit might dry up entirely, and Charlie Mitchell, as the head of the largest bank in the country, had a patriotic duty to reassure them. Accordingly, Mitchell hurriedly called a press conference on the morning of March 27th and announced that National City was prepared to inject $5 million into the call money market at an interest rate of 15%, additional $5 million, 1% rise in the rate until it reached 20%. Several other New York banks, Mitchell told reporters, had all expressed a willingness to supply additional funds to the market in case to ease the temporary credit contingency. Now, it wasn't a price problem, it was a credit problem. People couldn't borrow enough, right? At 20%.
Well, no. But, hey, what the heck, you know?
That guy could be, he'd be on CNBC, he'd be a regular today, wouldn't he?
He would. that's a pretty cool story.
Well, you know, you read this stuff, and for everybody, you know, everybody was young once, right? I mean, after all, every generation invents sex, even though you got here, right? So it is striking to me, the more you read about history, and the thing that really got me started, you know, as a younger age. Remember, who's the guy who did the Civil War, and then he did the baseball thing? What the hell is his name? He did several. His biggest one was the Civil War. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, Ken Burns, yeah.
Ken Burns. That the letters that he would pick out from people in those days, they're exactly like people would write today. I mean, people haven't changed. I mean, I don't know why people think people do change, but everybody thinks they do. They sort of don't. I mean, you know, it's the same.
What do you mean people don't change? Did those letters have emojis in them?
No, I don't think they did. And people had actually write them.
In chat speak?
Yeah, people had actually write them. Plus, the English was better. And the long story, but I ran into this Well, he ran into us. He showed up at our office out of the blue way back in the day. Kind of a disgusting creature, but I said, you know, there's no smoker in the office. He immediately lights up a cigarette, that kind of guy. But anyway, he was a guy who collected and actually had a business out in Vegas in documents, in like old, well, anything that was on paper that could be considered, you know, collectible. And the guy, as kind of disgusting as he was an amazing expert on this stuff. You know, just about everything that is written from the White House is written on paper that's actually made out of like a fiber, not wood. That a letter from like Abraham Lincoln to Ulysses S. Grant would still be as legible today as it was then. Because it wasn't on paper that degrades. It was on, what do they call it, rag paper or something?
Yeah, that sounds right.
And but he was talking about all these letters, you know, that a letter from Lincoln to a colonel elevating him to a general was worth, you know, $250, and you know, a letter from, you know, George Pullman to Henry Ford might be worth $100, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, I was fascinated by all of it. Not him, but boy, it's, you know, and I'm saying everybody in those days wrote everything out. Remember our guy, Ted Hesburgh. Yep. Like before the internet, what did he answer? 250 letters a day or something, or 225?
Okay, yeah, he answered all of them.
Yeah, and I'm sure he had a couple people helping him, but still, that's you know, everything was checked, punctuation, and I'm sure there wasn't a spelling error in any one of them. I mean, it was just a different time. And the weird part of it was, it really wasn't that. This is the strange part about all this, Kevin. In a lot of ways, things have been gotten way more efficient. But in total, they sort of didn't. I mean, that's the weird part of it all. It was a while ago, I read this thing about the then Speaker of the House. Because the Speaker of the House, don't they have the staff that puts together like all the bills and run, you know, makes copies and give them to everybody and all that stuff? I think they do all that. They do all the compiling. It's like the Speaker of the House's office. Well, this was a guy from, you know, like 100 years ago or 80 years ago or something. And he had something like 8 or 10 essentially Washington housewives that worked in his office. And they did X number of bills per year, you know, those kinds of things. And then flip forward however many years, and everybody's got computers and everything else. And his staff is like, this current staff is like 10 times bigger. And they did like a third as many bills or two-thirds as many bills. They didn't do any more. In fact, they did less. With like three times as many people and all the equipment in the world.
On the other hand, you'd find me saying they had fewer bills. I'm okay with that.
Oh, yeah. Well,
it's a general rule.
And they might have been longer. But I'm saying the idea was I would much rather see way more bills. I mean, I would like actually Illinois is messed up as people think it is. Once in a while, you see, you know, there's a big hue and cry if they don't do this, because they didn't do that with the COVID bill, I don't think. That was a big, big bitch. But I think in Illinois, it's like one subject, one bill, isn't it? I believe that's their story. And they actually pass a lot of bills because they cover one item.
Well, yeah, on that theory, yes, I'm on board with that. But I would be even happier if it was very narrowly focused bills and still fewer of them.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of stuff.
There's a compulsion out of legislatures at all levels to create laws. And, you know, it's like they feel that if they aren't creating some kind of law or another, that they aren't doing their job. And I would say that's misguided.
Right now, I think they should be getting rid of a lot of laws that are only enforced once in a while, which is very dangerous.
Yeah, that would be fine. That would be just fine with me, you know, but whatever it is. But, you know, the fact is we just keep piling law upon law upon law. Some of them are contradictory. So, I mean, we're all over the place on it. And part of that is because, you know, there's this compulsion to react to everything that happens, every bad thing that happens, especially with some kind of legislation. And, you know, you just can't fix it all. You can't make sure to, you know, how often do you hear that expression? We have to make sure this never happens again.
Yeah, well,
it's going to happen again. You know, how many times do I find myself sitting there, you know, just talking back to the TV saying, of course it's going to happen again. There ain't a damn thing you can do about it.
Well, but you also, that's sort of your job. If you're, if Kevin O'Neill gets elected, first thing you want is Kevin O'Neill proposes a law that people can't die. Okay, then.
Because we have to make sure that never happens again.
Well, but I mean, you also want your name out there.
Especially because we aren't making any new ones.
That's why you want your name out there. I mean, that's the story. I mean, as Mike Royko would have, you know, I don't know, famous, but a column about Adlai Stevenson said he never got his face out there, but behind the scenes he would write very serious position papers and a lot of topics that were very complicated and send it around to his fellow people, and he never got any recognition whatsoever. That's not what today's world wants. It's all about your face being out there. I mean, you're supposed to say the most ridiculous thing on Twitter. If you come on CNBC and everybody else says, you know, I can come on and talk about the stuff we talk about and the Fed and price ratios and how maybe things are a little too expensive or maybe some areas we think they're a little too cheap. We can do all that we want. But if I come out and say, Apple, everybody else is 210, 220 on their, I think Apple's going to be 300. That gets me a headline.
That'll do it, yeah.
Yeah. All right, Stocks and Jocks says PTI Securities recommends Apple 300. 300 by you know, whatever, next year. Okay, fine. That's, you know, what did John say? If it bleeds, it leads? You know, that's unfortunately the drill that I'm amazingly not looking forward to this campaign. God. You know, is it possible that people can run a campaign so away from any part of the issues that they both disqualify themselves?
Well, it's possible that they can run a campaign like that, but we don't disqualify anybody.
No, it's unfortunate. It is really, all the stuff that we've talked about in the last however many years, I'm going to say not one piece of it's going to touch the campaign. We're not even going to concern ourselves with the, I was looking yesterday, Lilly had came out with earnings, and they've got a couple of Mounjaro and some other drug. They're $1,200 a pop, Kevin. And these are you know, fatso drugs. And you know, insurance is paying for them. And what do you think? What's the other one? The Ozempic or the one that's the most popular? There was an article we read in a few weeks ago on CNBC. Lady says if you sold it for $5, you'd make a profit, and it's $1,000. How the hell can we take that big sucking sound out of the economy? And you know, just give it to some firms that don't even really pay the big dividends, you know. And then we're talking about Warren Buffett, and, you know, I love the guy, but I'll tell you what, $277 billion, Warren, pay a friggin' dividend. Send everybody a bone, will you? Send everybody $2 a share, for God's sake. We get the money into the system, let people actually use it. I mean, what are you doing? I mean, the drug companies, as much as they've, you know, earned, stolen, whatever side of the fence you're on through this whole COVID mess, Pfizer isn't going up. They're not rewarding shareholders at all. People just sucking it up on the, what Eric called this management level that thinks they deserve all the money. Because Eric said it was even better when you had robber barons. At least it was their company. I mean, yeah, it's, you wonder what, you know, these are the types of things when people, I mean, on Thursdays, always have this, you know, kind of discussion going on with Dan Janitis. And, you know, because Dan is, you know, first of all, Dan's really good at what he does, and he's a really great guy, and he's real smart. But he still is kind of a believer, and he probably is more right than I am. I mean, what the hell most people are. I mean, that, you know, these most companies are run, that he sees, they're run on the straight and narrow. The people who his companies that he goes invests in, Kevin, I'm going to say are on a scale of 1 to 10, the ones you deal with are probably a 4, and the ones he deals with are probably a 6, 6 or 7. But I think they don't act anything like the guys at the top. I mean, in the sense of, it's not like they're not bright. This guy, Elon Musk, the guy unabashedly will take billions of dollars out of this firm, and they'll never pay a dividend. Well, I don't think that's right, do you, if they're actually making money? I mean, shareholders deserve something other than to say I've been Tesla and this guy's my guy. I mean, I don't get it. I mean, Warren Buffett, never. I mean, no matter what happens, there isn't one shareholder there that can do better with his dollar that you give him than you can do. The fact that he's got $277 billion sitting there means he doesn't know what to do with it. Can he get by with $250? You know, I mean, it's kind of the... I don't know that the whole thing is necessarily working for shareholders, because there's going to be, if the market ever goes down, and I surely hope it doesn't, because everybody knows, Kevin, that I do a protected program, but you know what, that doesn't mean I want it to go down, because PTI has all kinds of clients, and you know, we have big clients that my brother or I will manage their money for. They might have 10 other accounts for, you know, nephews and nieces and kids where they've got, you know, 60 shares of Spiders or 50 shares of Accused. When it goes down, those accounts all lose. We don't want that to happen. You know, I mean, you can't hedge those things, right? those are the 25-year plan. Plus, you don't want to hedge them, probably. But the, you know, this whole idea of what share who gets, I think is really off. It once you get above the firms like you and Dan are talking to, and the firms that really are massive size, in massive, massive size, we're talking trillions of dollars, I think something's really wrong with the shareholder slash management slash leadership formula. And I think it's going to come home to roost. If we ever go down 40%, which like I said before, I don't help not, you're going to find CEOs that are somehow made $3 billion and the company went bust. You know, I mean, that's not right, I don't think. But
and I think, you know, you're dealing with different people, and you know, it's very, very similar to what you're dealing with a lot of government officials. So you're getting that same thing. Is, you know, it's people that are connected. In most cases, they've been sort of raised to believe that, you know, that this is who they are, that they're a better class of people, that they know better than the rest of us. And whether that is they know better how to spend money rather than paying dividends to investors, or they know better how to make laws that run our lives. It's just that there's a whole mindset to it, and you're not getting that at lower levels, because in many cases these are companies where, you know, the founder may still be running it. Even if it's a public company, the founders may still be running it, or you may be in the generation that came after the founders, and it's not necessarily a family generation that came after the founders. It's just people who are still connected to the principles behind the company, and those principles are a little bit different.
Yeah. But I mean, it comes out to one of the things in the last couple of weeks, and again, I'm not going to tell anybody to short it or not buy it or anything, but I am absolutely stunned at the rapidity of the calls to buy CrowdStrike down here. Kevin, the lawsuits haven't even hit the desk yet, have they? I mean, is nothing going to come of this? I mean, how do you, you know, you know, to the detriment, I guess, of some of my clients way back in the day, I would never invest in any of the tobacco companies for my clients. So my mother eventually died from issues of smoking. I mean, I'm certainly not a fan of cigarettes, but I didn't use that against, you know, doing investments for people. But I'm sitting there going, why would I invest in money in companies that are involved in like 1,000 lawsuits? And if all of a sudden they all started losing one after another, how can I explain to somebody, out of all the stocks in the New York Stock Exchange, well, in the NASDAQ too, as time went by, why did I have to pick these? I mean, I'm looking at this page, you know, I've got hundreds of stocks in front of me here from my clients have and stuff. What would possess me today to, out of all these stocks, where, you know, and they all could have a sneaky lawsuit someplace that you and I don't know about. I mean, there's a lot of information that we don't have. It pisses me off all the time, but why in the world would I put somebody's money in CrowdStrike right now, given the liability potential? And they'll probably get away with it. You know, And maybe it is a great buy down here in the dip, but why would I do that necessarily?
You wouldn't. I wouldn't.
And yet, stock's up another five. It's up another 550 this morning.
I'm not necessarily a the one to ask, just because I've long not been a fan of CrowdStrike. So
well, I mean that too. I'm listening to you and Carl, so I have even a little dimmer view. But even if I didn't know you guys, just thought, oops, they had this oopsie. All of a sudden, I'm thinking, God, Delta's so whatever. Why would I, out of all these stocks out here, pick any other one? You know, why would I pick that one necessarily? I mean, it's not like it's a screaming deal down at 245. I mean, it's not like it's trading five or something.
Why would you pick that one when there are good options? I mean, it's one of the things I really like when I listen to Dan on the show is he comes on and he says, yeah, we meet with the management. We assess the management team when we're looking at investing because, you know, ultimately, you know, companies are not on autopilot. I mean, they can be on autopilot for a little while, you know, when they have momentum or they have a successful product or something. But ultimately, it is really about the management, the people behind the strategy, their ability to execute it. You know, if you look at what's their name's Gartner, and does their technology assessments in various forms, and they always talk about the magic quadrant companies. Those are the ones. You know, the quadrant that is the one you want to be in is where you have a good vision for where your product line is supposed to go and the ability to execute. I mean, that's the big thing that they put on it is there's a lot of people who have good ideas. There are not very many who have the ability to execute on those good ideas.
Well, I would agree with that. What do you, have you heard, well, you know, you listen to most of the time, the conversation I was having with Lou a little bit regarding you know, the sports world and the amount of money that's, you know, massively generated. By the way, I think these Olympics are probably going to be okay. I mean, there hasn't been any problems so far, thank God, and there's been a lot of really good stuff. And
that nobody's focused on attacking the Olympics, not when you can go after Taylor Swift concerts.
Yeah. Well, what I'm saying is this whole medley here.
By the way, we know more, you know, a few days later, we know more about the plot and the people behind the threats on Taylor Swift concerts than we know about the Trump shooting weeks later.
Yeah, and well, I think
because everybody's just trying to cover their asses on the Trump shooting.
Well, they're also once the guy's dead, sometimes it's just a dead end. You don't know what the hell the guy was doing or thinking. I mean, he was kind of a loner, dead loner. It's I don't know. Well, I mean, I'm with you.
I'm just not buying dead loner. That it, you know, there's more to it than this.
There's always more to it, but yeah,
this just not does not seem like a guy who could have just pulled this off, you know, on his hot day. And this was well planned. There will be all kinds of signs out there. Plus, they knew him. They, you know, there's new footage today where they were trying to track him. You know, they were trying to find him. They had identified him long before as the guy with the backpack and all that. And they lost track of him. And then, you know, the local police officers' body cams, while they were, you know, when they were reacting, saying, "We told them to be on the roof there."
Well, you wonder if the Trump people heard any of this and ignored it. I bet they did. I don't think they did.
But heard it and ignored it. I don't know if the Trump people heard it and ignored it.
Well, if they would have said, don't go on, would he have gone on anyway? I don't know. I mean, it's kind of, you know, hey, but when we come back, let's, I mean, I always get fascinated by, you know, a lot of stuff we talk about economically and a lot of stuff we talk about sports-wise. I mean, obviously the theme of the show is they all come together. And I was asking Lou yesterday what he would think about going forward in terms of if he was buying a sports team. Of course, the people that buy it, it's all funny. I won't say funny money because it's real, but it's all money they got from some other place that it doesn't mean the same to them as probably does to you and me and the listeners. But having said that, there still has to be somebody with some kind of a plan that says, okay, how much are the Bears going to make 10 years from now, 8 years from now? What's the landscape going to look like? What's the antitrust landscape? Is there any danger there? Is there any danger here or there? Is there any chance people just say, screw it on football? I don't think so, but But what is the landscape going to look like? Can we pay if a quarterback is making $15 million a year? Can we sign some guy up for $50 million 8 years from now and have it be a deal, or are we going to be gagging on it? The reason why I ask, Kevin, is Warner Brothers got clobbered there for their earnings. It's down to like 704. It's actually up this morning to 704 because they're not going to get this NBA deal. I'm wondering if maybe they're better off. I don't know. So we'll talk about it after the break. SP Futures now only up 2. NASDAQ Futures up 7. So we're up, but not as much. But again, yesterday was a huge up day. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here. Right now.
Hello, Northbank Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Al Ricardo on the board. SP Futures up 275. NASDAQ Futures up 9.25. They were up a little bit more earlier. But we're still looking like we're pointing north after a pretty huge day yesterday. We have Dow Futures up 49. Individual stocks, I don't really see much moving. Apple's down $1.56. McDonald's down 78 cents, so nothing crazy. I do have Akamai is up $7. They had earnings, so they must have been pretty good. I said CrowdStrike's up $3.74, trading $244.24. So NVIDIA is up to $106.21 after trading under 100 during the Monday and Tuesday's kind of fiasco. So that's bounced back over $7. Over in Asia, we have the Nikkei up 193.6%, over 35,000, 35,025. Hang Seng up 198, that's 1%, over 17,000, 17,090. Shanghai down 7. Shanghai's either been not doing much or been down lately. Can't seem to get off the ground at all. 28.62. They actually had a higher than expected inflation rate in China, so that's probably one of the reasons that. Euro, over in Europe, the DAX up 63.4%. FTSE up 39.5%. CAC around up 34.5%. Again, yesterday, the great numbers. Dow up 683. S&P up 119. NASDAQ up 464, almost 3%. Gaining back just about everything I lost the other day. Benz down 4 basis points, 3.95. They've been running up this week. Dramatically different than you would expect with the Fed going to be doing a rate cut. The interest rates have been going up. Bund down 3 basis points, 2.23. Japan up 1 to 0.85. Oil up 35 cents, creeping up on the bottom end of this range. The oil's got a 3% weekly gain, and it's still only 76.54. That's how much it went down last week. Brent down 32 cents, 79.48. Natural gas up 2 cents, 2.14. RBOB unchanged, 2.40. Gold, which had a big rally yesterday, it's up 7.40 today, 24.70. Silver up 3 cents, 27.64. But that gold number, the 24.70, is a December number. The spot number August is 24.20. But the December is 24.70. On FX, we have the 109, same spot for the euro, 127.4, same spot for the British pound. However, the yen is down 31. The yen is at 146.94. So again, the yen made it to 163 when it was getting hammered, and it strengthened back up to 143. Now it's basically 147. So big movements in a currency there. A Bitcoin up 763, back up over 60,000. 60,454 trading under 50,000 on Monday morning. So it's been a big week for those guys. We have, of course, traffic, weather, sports.
Morning, Chief. It's currently 6:34 a.m. here in beautiful Chicago. 61 degrees right now with a high of 75 today. Kind of an early taste of fall. Breezy and not as warm with sunshine and some clouds. Tonight will be breezy as well. Otherwise clear to partly cloudy. Low of 59 degrees. So in Phoenix, Arizona, 87 degrees right now with a high of 108. Partly sunny and very warm. Tonight will be partly cloudy and as well very warm with a low of 90 degrees. On the traffic in Chicago, inbound Kennedy from Monroe's 12 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lane Cook, 27 minutes. We're looking at 23 minutes. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th, 16 minutes. And Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan, 23 minutes. Lastly, sports yesterday in the MLB, the Diamondbacks lose to the Phillies 4-6. And today we got the Crosstown Classic in Chicago. White Sox play the Cubs at 7:10. The Diamondbacks play the Phillies again at 8:40 p.m. today as well. Lastly, the 2024 Summer Olympics are in session. The medal tracker states that the U.S. is in first place with the medals with 103 medals. China is in second place with 73, and France is in third place with 54 medals. That's all I got for you, Chief. Back over to you.
Kevin, if we invent even like the world's craziest, but I was watching rock climbing last night. Is there anything people even can think of doing that's not in the Olympics these days?
I don't know. I think they should have some kind of sex competition. Do you remember the Woody Allen film, Bananas.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And Howard Cosell when they got to the wedding night and Howard Cosell called the play by play.
Oh God, yeah, I do remember. When you got 200,000 condoms, and I think there is a sex. There's any medals.
Yeah, we just need to get the cameras rolling.
and are we doing positions like the Kama Sutra? Or are we doing?
Style points.
You got it.
That's all. So yes, how do they do it in gymnastics? The degree of difficulty. Yeah. factor. we just go with that.
Oh God. I don't even want to consider what those. I'll tell you what. There's a lot of beautiful girls in that thing, and probably a lot of good looking guys too. I mean, there are. I mean, it's a. I can see where there's some action, but
A lot of very fit, very attractive, fairly young people.
I just would want to be the guy whatever my sport was, I'd want it to be like the first day. So if you win the first day, do you hang there for 2 weeks or do you leave? I mean,
Some people hang and some people leave. I think there's a lot of people that want the whole experience and they want to be around for the closing ceremonies and all of that, but there are others who I'm sure they don't stay for 2 weeks and they just hightail it out of there.
If you won your first day and you got a gold medal around your neck, you would think you could get some action, unless you're just like some total dud.
You better be trying. You know, you're not trying. Let's put it this way: if you ain't panting, you aren't trying.
What did my politically incorrect uncle used to say? He couldn't get lucky in a women's prison with an armload of pardons. anyway, not for the show. But I'm wondering.
It is a family show, Tom.
Yeah, it is a family show. I'm wondering if some of these things, some of the stuff that's happened. Remember, I just got a question from a listener and a good friend about Walgreens coming out with a $750 million kind of junk bond thing. I was going to ask Dan about that today, maybe we'll talk about it on Monday. Are those things good buys or not? I mean, that would be a Dan question, not me. But I'm wondering, I look at this, you see the incredible enthusiasm for companies, and I've always been amazingly down, not amazingly, but seriously down on Amazon, because I think they grew their whole thing based on their people not paying sales tax back in the day. So they had an amazing advantage starting up, which none of our legislators should ever have let happen, that the people who actually build buildings and have people have to pay sales tax, and if you go online, you didn't have to. I mean, now I think they pretty much have to, but still.
Well, you did have to.
Well, you just didn't.
You just didn't have anybody who collected it.
Right, right. Well, you definitely were supposed to, but what
you
percentage?
Owned it, but you didn't. But nobody was taking it out of your cold dead hands.
And it's another law that was never ever enforced. Now I'm thinking, I'll use the man's name because he happens to be governor, but I'm thinking that the reason why it's never enforced is because if you got the 10, 10 worst offenders, they'd probably be 10 of the governor's friends. It would be his wife going to jail for buying a TV online and not paying tax on it. I'm not the governor. I don't mean Jay personally, but I mean, I think if you did that, you'd essentially be spanking the people that you least want to. That's the reason why these laws are useless. If you actually read that law, it is serious. If you buy something out of state and you don't pay sale, you're supposed to pay a sales tax. And oh, by the way, if you buy a lot of stuff, it's over a certain amount, you're supposed to pay quarterly. When's the last time anybody of note ever got slapped with that? Other than the guy from, what was the name of the firm? They used to own the Sun-Times Hollinger, where he bought the big items at auction in New York and them shipped to New Jersey. Tell us his name. He went to jail for it. That was the board that Big Jim Thompson was at. Hollinger. Remember those guys?
Yeah, I don't, Tom. I don't remember the
situation. Yeah, they eventually got him for buying these high-end art things and have them shipped to New Jersey and not paying the tax in New York. But that was a game in New York forever. I mean, if you lived in New Jersey and you bought something in Manhattan, you had it shipped to your house, they have to pay taxes. Everybody who was big never paid tax on a suit in their life if you lived in New Jersey. Just saying. Well, I get back to because it ties into the rest of the show, Kevin. When you see the sports situation, again, Amazon and some of these other people, Peacock, Prime, and all these other guys, all of a sudden bidding up huge on these games. You know, we're talking football, we're talking baseball, we're talking basketball, whatever it is. And they're paying like kind of an arm and a leg higher than the current people are paying. And yet all the current people seem to be gagging on the price they are paying.
Yep, ESPN for sure has been.
And the same way with Warner Brothers, they've had the basketball forever, right? At the Warner Brothers Discovery, they got the NBA, I think, a lot of it. Isn't that their big deal?
Turner had the NBA. Is that Warner Brothers?
I think it is, yeah.
Okay, I believe you.
I know
Turner is not owned by Turner anymore. I knew that for a while. That's been a long time.
Well, they essentially have this contract that they went out for bid, and Amazon and a couple others have bid a real lot. Now, whether they're just pieces of it or whatever, and the contract seems to say that they get allowed to match. But now they're not letting them match. There's a big lawsuit. And I don't really, you know, Lou probably knows more about it. But the bottom line is, do we want to buy the company because they didn't get the contract? You know, it's down to $7. I mean, I don't know. I'm asking. I mean, right now, are the winners going to be really the losers? You know, I mean, I don't know if you were to put, you know, we'll ask Ricardo. Ricardo is a gentleman of Hispanic descent. How many of your friends sit there watching the NFL every Sunday?
The NFL?
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I got to tell you, I think people my age, you know, I think these are at least Hispanic people that grew up here, you know, they have a little bit of a bigger connection to American sports, you know. I didn't really grow up here, you know, so I don't really be watching all that stuff. But I do have a lot of like Hispanic friends that will watch that like over soccer and stuff, you know.
Okay.
Just that they grew up here and stuff, you know. It's more like a cultural thing, you know.
Well, I'm trying to do, and this is very, very difficult. What is the landscape going to look like 8 years from now? Because some of these contracts are 8 years for these people. What's the landscape going to look like 8 years from now for football, basketball, baseball? It seems to me that they're really pricing themselves on this gambling, which I don't know about that. I'm talking to me. What do you think, Kevin?
To the extent that they are. And I don't understand what the team's cuts out of gambling are at this point. I that would take a little bit of work for me to check that out. But because they are affiliated with it, there is a cut.
What's the cut?
And so this isn't a new source of revenue in the economy. This is just a source of revenue that has moved from illegal to legal. And not all of it has moved from illegal to legal, but a fair amount of it has, and so it is not an infinite. You know, it's not going to be a growth area. It's a very short term hit that is then going to be baked in as a standard revenue stream. There is just not going to be much of a way to grow it. So when you start looking at the products themselves,
is gambling a growth product, or is gambling just a cash cow that they can milk now? I think it's just a cash cow. So now, as you start looking forward, where is their growth? In some cases, it's international, but I don't know that that's as big as some people as the leagues think it's going to be. Yeah, you could put Major League Baseball in Mexico City and do really well. You could probably, but you know, how far are you going to expand? There's a lot of places you could probably put it in Puerto Rico and do well, but that's a very finite size market because you run out of real estate for it. So the growth isn't that good there. Where else in Mexico are you going to put it? You're not going to Venezuela. You're not going to Guatemala, because now all of a sudden you're putting travel demands on your teams that they're not going to, that the players aren't going to want. Of course, the players will negotiate anything for enough money. So I think they're kind of capped. When I look at them as a growth industry, I don't see it. Some people do, but I don't.
Well, I'm a little bit of a Luddite here, but I used to love to gamble, okay? I mean, well, now I trade all day, so some people would say I'm still gambling, but that's not the way I look at it. Kevin, if you and I bet on the Bears, duh, Bears, or somebody, or Notre Dame, we're going to take the points, and the odds have not changed. It's still 11 to 10, right? I mean, none of that's gone up, so we still put up $110 to make 100, correct?
No, it depends on the bet, but sure.
Well, I'm saying there's gimmick bets and other stuff, but how does the NFL get any of that? That's where the money is. I mean, if you lease somebody a gambling booth, for lack of a better term, at Soldier Field or Wrigley Field, yeah, you probably can charge an arm and a leg for the spot, because people are running over there and making their bets, but I don't see the VIG going to 12 to 10 and the teams getting half of that. I don't see that at all. And I don't think there's enough.
That's why I said I'd have to see what the business model is for this, because I don't understand where they're getting huge money. Unless they are negotiating, the leagues are negotiating something for distribution that says, we'll advertise you, we'll promote you, we'll support you. And you do see that. I mean, every pregame show now has what are the good bets of the day. So there's kind of this, it's more than coexistence. There's a symbiotic relationship there. But again, I don't see that as a huge growth area for them.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm thinking. I think it's the advertising.
Conversations with Dan all the time. And he will talk about the management, but he will also talk about, where is the product going? And if you don't have, substantial portfolio of growth products, then you're not really that. It's not that you can't continue to exist and do well over the long haul, but you're not, where are you going to get this extra value? How are you going to bid up the price for your media rights? How are you going to bid? I don't see it. And if anything, I'd kind of go the other way, that in my exposures to young people, they are much more interested in other things than sports. A lot of people into online gaming, a lot of people into, social media related activities. I don't see it. I don't see where the growth in those industries are. So, I am absolutely not willing to discount franchise owners and the league's ability to be completely stupid. So,
well,
let's see what happens.
Well, just on something simple, if you and I were hired by Ricketts, I don't know if I'd want to work for him, I think, I'm going to lob this out there, I think from what I understand on the revenue for people in the park, I'm going to say you're up to probably 60, I mean, I have sources that have got this kind of right from the source. I think 60 to 65% of the seats now are not purchased by the person who's behind is in the seat. There's some sort of corporate thing or something. And there's an upper crust to that, that some of the best seats in the place, maybe 50 per game or something, or maybe 100, because I used to be able to get these seats. But I didn't really have to pay over for them because my buddy knew the ticket guy. But anyway, another story. But I think there's also a set of tickets that if all of a sudden Boeing has people in from God knows where, from Paris, and they want to go to a Cub game, they call and they'll get the best seats in the house for maybe three or four times face or something along those lines. And so there's a real source of revenue for those 100 or 200 seats that are essentially on call for, I'll use the term, the big shots from the south side. So now if we were to price the tickets, how much per year increase can you do the normal schlumps like me, the guys that are in the upper deck or not in the box seats, that used to be the grandstand, now what they call them, the field boxes or something, upper reserved or some crap. Are we talking 4% a year, 5, 10? We just had a massive inflation thing that I think is gagging most people. I mean, are we talking about $100 for an upper deck seat? I mean, I think we probably are. Now, is that going to be 210 years or is it going to be 125? Big difference. I don't know how I would. Now, are the corporations, are they going to be fat and happy like they seem to be now? Or somewhere along the line, we've had a couple iterations in my lifetime where all of a sudden somebody said, we don't want these idiots writing off these tickets. Why do they get to write off these tickets? And matter of fact, one of the guy who works with us at PTI, his wife ended up with the Merrill Lynch tickets at Old Comiskey because Merrill Lynch was embarrassed that they had like row two behind the plate. And all the corporations, this had to be, you know, somewhere in the 80s when there was a problem with the markets and they bagged on all their tickets. I mean, can you just sit there and say, you know, Kevin O'Neill brings the thing back or one of your students, yep, looks to us like 10% a year, every year, go for it. I don't know, you believe that or do you? I don't know. I don't know what the number would be, so I can't grade the paper, but I have real trouble right now predicting what things are going to be like 8 years from now, Kevin.
Yeah, I do too, and I think, you know, we also see that with player contracts, don't we?
Yeah.
You know, there's a thought process behind them, but when it gets right down to it, there's a lot of long-term contracts that are proved to be not worth it.
Well, but if you ask, I mean, you know, you and I, you've taught this, but I used to do this when I was at Pullman. I mean, what are we going to do if we give Ricardo, because he's 26 years old, he's as good a center fielder as there is. It looks to us like center fielders that are that good make, he's a scale of 8 on a scale of 1 to 10, he's an 8, 8.5. We're going to pay him 12. That seems to be the going rate. Well, that's fine, because we already have our ticket sales for next year. We know what our revenue is. But now, 6 years from now, or 8 years from now, Ricardo, even if he eats the right food and doesn't drink too much and doesn't smoke and doesn't chase women, he's probably going to be a 6.5 and center fielders. Now he's going to be a big fan favorite like Ernie Banks, where it doesn't matter. He's a national treasure, a city treasure. Probably not. Maybe he is. He's got the personality for it. He actually does. Now, what is a 6.5 out of 10 going to make 8 years from now? Can we still be paying Ricardo the 12 mil or even 14, having the thing go up and have him be a bargain? Or all of a sudden, is he going to be Soriano where he's making 14 and we can find other guys this is good for 4? I mean, that Kevin, that's a tough call. I mean,
I agree with you that it is, and I think it's, they make their bets, but they're all playing with funny money, and I think the belief is that the equity in the franchises, the value of the franchises, will go up indefinitely, and so far that's been a pretty good predictor. That's been true, but I don't think it's going to be true indefinitely.
How much do you think the Tribune made on that? They bought it from the Wrigleys at 21, right? They sell it for what, 80 or something? 60?
Yeah. And Bill Vecchio used to say, even when his teams had cash flow issues, he never had investors who didn't make money. But they always made money on the value of the franchise when he finally sold it.
Well, and a lot of that is...
you're just flipping houses, right?
Well, how much of that is... But houses aren't a monopoly. Baseball is. How much of that is because it's monopoly? But we're up to a number... the last one that sort of traded, I used the Mark Cuban franchise when the lady bought the lady from what's her name's daughter, the guy from Wynn, Las Vegas Sands, tells his name, the daughter, the guy croaked, so she was able to take the stock and not pay taxes on it, right? Because she got the piggy move up on the price. So she spent how many billion dollars that valued the Dallas Mavericks. Well, if that game ends, if the stock market drops, the money becomes much more dear. I mean, there's not a whole lot of people that have worked their whole life that can pony up $2 billion, Kevin. What kind of job is that? I would like to have one. So it all kind of comes together. The funny money that the Fed put in during COVID, on top of the stuff they did all the years before, all of a sudden went into a few hands, and one of the places it absolutely went to are these monopoly ball teams, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, but the question is, can it come out as fast as it went in? I mean, what would the rest of society look like if it did? Not so sure that would be cool, would it?
No, and so we are, we're just in a weird place when it comes to this stuff. And I like sports a lot, and I really don't want to see it crash and burn, but I suspect that at some point they're going to have their reckoning. And I don't know what that's going to mean to their sports, but I just can't see it continuing like this.
Well, we got a few minutes. What do you think the toll, if any, is going to be on college sports? We just had our reunion at Notre Dame. I talked about it, so everybody probably remembers. The last thing I want to do is remember the fact that I went to a reunion. But we saw Dave Casper and a few of the other guys at the reunion that actually graduated with me, went on and had NFL careers, and they don't walk so good. But these are guys that I was in class with. I mean, they were there for 4 years. They had some benefits that I didn't have. I'm not that naive. But by and large, they were students. They were people that I could root for, because at least I knew the guy sitting right next to me, for God's sake. Same way with the hockey players. They were all our buddies. I played bridge and I played golf with all those dudes. So I was really into the hockey team. Now, right now, our guys are sending around all the stuff about we got this guy and that guy. I've talked to 5 or 6 people, Kevin, that they almost don't care whether Notre Dame wins or loses at this point, because it's just another professional team. Now, our guys clearly have not gone there yet. I'm not so sure. A lot of people are not into this new program. I mean, I think the schools that are just going to go get their ass kicked every week by some school that's paying everybody a fortune, I don't know how long they hang in there. I mean, I don't. Boston College or somebody like that, I'm just picking their name out, or even Northwestern, which is one I always talk about. If they aren't all in on this pay everybody all they want game, the Northwestern versus Ohio State's games are going to look even more ridiculous than they do now. I mean, at some point, if you're not into this new mantra, you're not going to be in at all, because it's going to be like a high school team playing other people, I think. Maybe not. Maybe there's going to be a coach somewhere that can get the right people, and there'll be a Newt Rockne or a Leahy somewhere that can once in a while get a team that challenges. But I don't see how they're going to challenge every year when other people are paying a bunch and you're not. What is this going to do to the fandom? Where, I love going to Wisconsin games, but Wisconsin's not paying people enough, so every week we get our ass kicked. I mean, or I don't want to be paying those people that much. If they do, if it's a pro team, I'm not interested. I'll go watch the Packers. Someplace, somewhere here, I think there's some risk. Just saying.
Well, there is some fallout that I think this is why this is why you have a movement for sort of a super league, a super football league, where I don't want to say it, where there'll be somewhere between 40 and maybe as many as 64 teams who kind of split off from everybody else, and they run their big time sport, and everybody else gets to run it like college football was run once upon a time. And I think part of that is because of how these big franchises want to operate and the money that they think they can make. And part of that is they are tired of sharing their money with people who don't
who don't want to put out in the same way. Well, and I mean put out in the horriest sense of the word.
Yeah, yeah. Well, my reunion. The new Notre Dame Stadium. Well, it's not new, but I didn't realize that they'd put a whole bunch of skyboxes on the other side, Kevin. That's how long it's been since I went to a game. I look at that place and I go, it's gorgeous, but it's not me. I just had the weirdest feelings when I was there. We're in some gorgeous...
I don't think it's gorgeous on the outside. I think it's ugly on the outside.
Well, but I mean, in the skyboxes, we got 600 people in a banquet room that's terrific, overlooking the field and every...
Okay.
The stuff they put there, there isn't a pro team that's any better than that. And I look at this, and now all of a sudden, everybody who's a one percenter has got a skybox, and you don't sit in the stands with the rest of the people. And I'm going, this isn't me. This isn't the 59,000 people sitting out here in the cold and the rain watching your team play. This is, I don't know what it is.
I know what it is. It's a social event. It has nothing. It has very little to do with football itself.
But it's a money event. I mean, the Morris Inn is what, $500 a night? It used to be 50. I mean, Jesus. I mean, it's not just the money. It's not just if I can afford it, but it's not just. I want to sit next to regular people. If I go there, I want to sit next to the people from Mississippi State that are there or whatever, and learn about them. I don't want to be in some skybox with a bunch of rich idiots that are boring as hell.
And you don't get to watch. You don't get to watch the game unless you just want to separate yourself from that pack and go sit out in the seats there, and maybe every once in a while someone will trickle out and say, "Oh, what's all the commotion? Was there something going on out here?" The skybox experience is totally lost on me too.
I love them at like Wrigley or something. That's kind of cool because you're right there, and then you do sit outside, but. That's
well, the best for that that I've ever done was Miller Park, and I did go to the opening for that, and I got invited. It was Ameritech at the time, and our sales rep invited me, and really the only two people who were out watching the baseball game were me and my sales rep's husband.
Oh, God. Well, real quick before we go to...
Everybody else was inside. We're baseball fans. We're here to watch the game. But... The thing about it's not Miller Park anymore. I forget what they call it, but in Milwaukee, the way they did it is they have the 300 level sky suites like everybody else does, but they have behind all the box seats on the 100 level, they have just elevated enough off of the aisle that you the people walking in front of you don't bother you, but they have suites. Around the stadium there, so they have they have the box seat view from a suite, and then they built the 200 level on top of those suites. So actually, you could go to a game and get a really good view of the game from there.
Well, the ones in Yankee Stadium, which I was in a couple times, the old Yankee Stadium, they were actually behind the grandstand. They were horrible seats, but they had the chow and the TVs and stuff, and the. The definition of economic obsolescence when it comes to a stadium.
Anything more than 15 years old?
No, not enough skyboxes.
Oh, okay.
So Yankee Stadium, the old Yankee Stadium, which is an incredible place, basically there weren't any skyboxes. They were behind the grandstand. Before we go to Carl here, we'll go right to him, but the best skybox, actually the best seat of any in baseball that I've ever, I haven't been to all the parks, but best seat I ever had in the world's worst park was in Old Comiskey. The way the upper deck came around behind home plate, if you had the first one or two rows behind home plate, if you got stiff and tumbled off the thing, you damn near landed on the umpire. I mean, you were that close. But there's skyboxes both there and at Wrigley, but even more so at Old Comiskey. They actually did have skyboxes for like a year or two before they tore it down. They hung them under the upper deck. Kevin, If you fell out, I think you landed on the field. you were so close in those skybox seats. I mean, they were basically right under the first row's upper deck.
What you're describing is similar to the way the old Tiger Stadium was, where the outfield upper deck actually hung farther out than the wall at the lower level, so you could on occasion have a home run that would land in the at the top of the upper deck that would have been caught if it were allowed to complete its trajectory.
And those seats are great. The first few rows like that, man, you're just right. Anyway, Kevin, talk at you next week. Have a nice weekend. We got Carl. We're going to go right to Carl, Ricardo?
Oh, you can.
Sure, why not do that? What do you make of what we've been talking about? If you were predicting on baseball, football, basketball in terms of these contracts, how would you decide what you were doing? We talk about dangers in the economy. These guys, some of them seem full speed ahead. Obviously, Amazon and a few people. Some of the other guys that are kind of licking their wounds, old ESPN and Warner Brothers, going maybe not so much, and they're getting outbid. Who's smart there, those guys or the other guys?
Well, that's kind of tough to know. I mean, it's, I know where you're coming from, but I have issues with the whole premise that this is really anything more than just a manifestation of all the excess credit that's flying around.
Well, the prices are, I'm positive.
Well, yeah. I mean, and it's actually, it's kind of interesting because there's an article that I have in the queue for tomorrow. All the screaming, of course, it started about rate cuts, right? Because, you know, we got a swoon the other day.
It's going to save the world, Carl.
Oh, no. This one was actually rather amusing because this is coming from an industry group and a journal that caters to the commercial real estate market. And as I've pointed out for a long time, and in fact, it's one of the reasons I was successful with my internet company, is that the commercial real estate model is you never pay off a note, ever. It's always rolled over. You build things in the commercial space predicated upon being able to cash flow the interest payments. Okay, essentially all commercial real estate is an IO loan. Essentially all of it. All right.
Your appreciation is 1% more or 2% more than your note.
Well, as long as I can cover the interest payments on a perpetual basis, I never actually have to pay back the money.
Right, and you don't want to.
Well, but this is the cash flow model. This is the business model of commercial real estate. It's always been that way. It at least as far back as I've ever paid
but it's
any
not,
attention to it.
Okay, but it's not just commercial real estate. I mean, if you and I were to buy, you know, let's pick a company that's
I get what you're saying. Okay, yes, this is the model of American business in general. Okay, is that nobody pays off their issuances? They just roll them. Okay, fine.
You realize you just led me to some huge question here, but go on when you're done.
Well, I know, but okay, fine. That's fine. This is the model. But all of these people who did a knowingly stupid thing rolled all this paper. 5 years, and by the way, the term on commercial paper for this purpose is usually between 5 and 10 years. Nobody ever does anything longer than that because they don't want the duration because that means the price goes up, right? So they all do relatively short term. You don't want to be 1 or 2 years; that's too sensitive. But everybody does 5 or 10. All right, and that is the tenor on essentially all commercial real estate paper that's outstanding and always has been. As long as I've been in any way interested in business, that's how it's always worked. It's why MCS was able to get space in TruPru at $8 a foot. Because I took advantage of somebody else who got in trouble, vacated the space, and they were in danger of violating covenants. All right.
Well, they actually have to be leased, and sometimes the covenants don't have a price in them.
Well, that's right, and so
which is pretty ignorant, by the way. But
I am. Look, where does opportunity as an entrepreneur? What I want is a dislocation caused by somebody else's stupidity, because that is how innovation works. Is that you step into someone else's stupidity? Okay. Now, not only did I get this space at $8 a square foot, it had cube systems in it. So the only thing I had to do was change the data wiring because the people that wired it originally were stupid. And I knew how to do that myself. I didn't have to pay somebody. Because the cable was there, but the termination was wrong. So, but that was not hard. Well, okay.
There's a
But Chief, think about what it would have cost me to buy those cubes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I mean, that's an insane amount of money, and I didn't have to pay a dime for it. Now, of course, they weren't mine. I couldn't take them with me when we left, right? They were part of the building. But the point was, I didn't have to buy them. All right, I had to buy a conference table because there wasn't a conference table.
Well, in order for this to happen, though, you had to be the right size, and you knew what you were doing. It's 175, the building that we talk about. We were in that building for a long time. Now, we've been over here for, I'm going to say, 20-some years, but... when we were looking to leave, some group, you would have been, God, I can only imagine, because you would have known what the stuff was. You'd have been, your eyes would have been like saucers. We walk into this office, they had a room, this is an old building. They had a room that was absolutely air-conditioned control for their big-ass servers and stuff. They had all these desks and all this stuff. There was some massive trading firm that had like nothing but dough. And put this place together, Carl. It was, if you and I would have a trading firm of 40 people, we could have dropped in this thing, and within a weekend, you'd have got it up and running. I wouldn't have known how to do it, but they were the company lost. I think they lost all this money. Remember when the Revco had that currency thing where the guy who was the guy who was
oh
the,
yeah
the
yeah
guy
yeah
the guy was the governor of New Jersey in the center, and he was running the place.
Yeah, there was a Corzine thing.
Yeah, it was a Corzine. And all these guys, the building didn't see anybody, and they opened up the door on a Tuesday. They were gone.
Yeah.
They were just gone. And they had like 30 people there. All the personal computers, everybody's hat and coat was gone. All these big servers. But anyway, you could have got that thing for nothing. Because what was I going to do with it? What am I going to do with some massive servers taller than me?
Well, the company that screwed the building was Donnelly Director.
Okay.
Okay, they just disappeared in the middle of the night one night.
Oh God! Yeah. Well, that happened.
Well, I mean, but here's the thing: is that I mean that's, but that was an opportunity for somebody else, me. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So these guys are screaming that we've got to have these rate cuts. Because, oh my God, it's going to be apocalypse now for everybody in the CRE space. And my answer to that is, let's have the apocalypse. Because, there's going to be plenty of people taking a backside, and that's the way it happens. However, from that comes progress. From that comes opportunity. From that comes entrepreneurship. From that comes all the things that make America good. And that somebody else did a stupid thing and ends up having to pay for it is not a bad thing. It's a good thing. How do you ever reduce the amount of stupidity in the world? The only way is that when you get spanked by being dumb.
Well, the issue with that, sometimes the wrong people. I don't know if you listened yesterday, but I was talking to Dan about when you talk to clients. And Dan and I both do work for other places, so... There's people we talk to that really aren't, for lack of a better term, my client or his client.
Right.
And you get a different, shall we say, a different brand of alley cat. Is that a nice way to put it or not even a nice way to put it? You get people that, I mean, the people who originally at PTI way back when we first started it, we'd have seminars all the time, and everybody wanted to be in the Protect Index program before the market went up every day. Literally from 90-something to 2008, 2009, and now people went back in. But we did that. We would have seminars, and we would get 35, 40 people, and we'd explain exactly kind of what we were doing, how it matched up, and if, by the way, if you're putting $1,000 in an account for your son, you don't need the Protect Index program. Just put it in there. I mean, that type of thing. Of course, market wasn't like it is now, but still. But what I noticed in these people I talk to from places that aren't here, because to be perfectly blunt, we do a better job on our clients here because we're more involved. I mean, you have people, not only have you seen the fixed income piece, the part where as you age, you put a little bit more in fixed income, that whole formula is by the boards. Everybody wants to be in the most risky stuff. But the difference is this has been going on now for, let's say, what, 10 years? Really, since 2007 for sure, right? Maybe even 2000, but say 2007. The market's really gone straight up since then, pretty much. There's been a couple of blips here and there. But nobody, everybody wants all in. Nobody wants any part of fixed income. And, you know, Dan and I have had, we have actually at PTI probably, you know, 20 or 25%, especially for our older people, are in T-bills. There's no reason to be 100% in here. And I'm not saying the market's going down or I'm not giving market advice, but what's happened, Kyle, it's weird. And when you say that everybody needs to take it up to behind once in a while, I don't disagree with that at all. Yet, I will say this, is a lot of the people now that I talk to in 2007 or 2008 were 60 years old and were working. And their portfolio was worth maybe a half a mil or 400,000 or something along those lines, which this is not chump change. This is a real portfolio.
Right.
Now they're, it's 17 years ago, now they're 77.
Right.
And 90% of it is in the same high growth stuff. Nobody wants to be in fixed income. The bank doesn't pay anything, even though fixed income is up quite a bit. I think Dan's up in some of his municipals this year. He won't say it, but I think he's up 6.5%, which tax affected is like 10 or 11 after fees.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, that's pretty damn good. I mean, because Dan's really good. And I'll say it, even though he won't. But, I mean, now the difference is the conversation is different. But try and have that conversation with somebody. Hey, buddy, you're not 60 anymore. You're not working. You've got 90% of your money in the seven big stocks, and you're up to 2 mil, thank to God. But why do you want to? Why do you have the same strategy you did when you were working and your account was a quarter of the size? You've changed. You've changed. The market's changed. I'm just kind of pointing it out to you. I'm not giving advice. I'm just saying the next 17 years. I'll go out on a limb and say are not going to be like the last 17 years. They never are, right?
Yeah. Here's my point, the article that's going to post is on the no ad side because it is full of extremely rough language. I am tired of this game, and we cannot afford this game anymore, where somebody does a bunch of stupid stuff. Sometimes they even go beyond stupidity and into rank criminality, okay? I.e., the whole reason that I'm blackballed on all of the major networks is that I called this out. You had investment bankers who were slicing and dicing mortgages, which is a perfectly legal thing to do. People take different amounts of risk and they get a different amount of return. Okay, nothing wrong with doing that. You take a package of loans and you split them off. I mean, Davicoli was one of the people that pioneered figuring out how to do this stuff. Very smart woman. She still lives in Chicago, by the way. And nothing wrong with that. What is wrong is that when you have a bunch of guys on a trading desk who are selling this stuff off to supposedly sophisticated investors, who are saying among themselves in emails, and this has been established, that this stuff's vomit. Literally vomit. In other words, the defaults have already started. They know that these sub-tranches are worthless. They're going to be completely wiped out. And they're out there peddling them to people as good investments.
Carl, some of them were synthetic.
I know they were.
Yeah.
Chief, the point being, that's a felony, okay? And that is deliberate misrepresentation. There's a word for that. It is a crime. It's fraud. And we have bailed out not just poor decisions, we've bailed out frauds, we've bailed out felons, and we've done it repeatedly. And now we have the people within the commercial real estate market are screaming for the government to come in and do it again. Well, you know what? The market turned in 2009, and people say, oh, you know, the Republicans or oh, the Democrats or whatever. The market turned in 2009 on the very day that Congress, in their infinite wisdom, told FASB in a hearing, I listened to it, that either FASB allow the banks to take to consider whatever they wanted as their marks. The current market price was irrelevant. You do this or we're going to legislate it.
Well, the people...
Congress, Chief, you can't defend that, okay? Congress said fraud is a legitimate business model. You can lie on your balance sheet and in your financials. And if you don't allow companies to do this, we're going to make it a statute.
Carl, it's endemic along the way. You don't know if you've been bored, maybe, with everybody else and me reading this stuff from 1929. It's the exact same stuff.
I get that, but you know what? We are, look, as I've pointed out in a couple of shows now, and as I wrote a rather long article about it, this kind of thing, I understand, people love it because, you know, we're making money, da-da-da-da-da-da. Okay, fine. Guess what? The young people of the country have figured the game out. They're not going to play.
It does seem that way, doesn't it?
They have figured out that the reality of it is this. If they make a child, look, you have $35 trillion in debt on the federal credit card right now, all right? If you make a child, you are creating a slave. Literally, a slave.
Well, some of the stuff, I mean, just...
Well, now, wait a minute. Okay. Now, you're not going to pay that $35 trillion back.
No.
The people who are currently here are not going to pay the $35 trillion back. We know that. It's not going to be extracted from any of the people who actually...
Nobody's ever going to pay it back. The trick is...
Well, but you're going to try to assess...
You're going to try and grow faster than the growth of the loan.
Which, by the way, has never worked.
Well, it works, okay. Because it would work, but they just keep lying to themselves.
Well, no. No, because you just keep issuing faster and faster.
Well, I mean, okay. in the last 4 years, or maybe 6 years, you had the Trump people come out with a tax thing, which, by the way, a lot of that's going to expire pretty soon, isn't it? But they came out with this big tax decrease.
Oh, no, it'll be extended. You watch.
Well, okay. It'll probably be extended, but it came out and it went to the Congressional Budget Office,
right.
and everybody is under the assumption that we know we have this debt, and the only way you can get something like that through their own rules or their own conventions, there's no such thing as rules, I guess, for those people, was to say that this is actually going to be accretive towards the deficit rather than the other way. So they came out with some long story that, you know, it's like the Kennedy tax cut from 90 to 70 or something, that somehow or another everybody's going to keep so much money that these big guys are going to spread it around and we're actually going to get accretive, you know, tax returns because of this. Okay, well, that's such a load of crack. When you start lowering from 30 to 25 or 22, anyway, I don't think I could have signed on to that. And then 4 years later, you get another guy in there, and he says, by the way, we've got this $1.5 trillion, call it what you want, infrastructure bill. Because the bridges are going to be better, and everybody's going to have 5G in the worst neighborhoods, they're all going to make so much more money, and everybody's going to get to work so much faster, that this is actually accretive, and it's going to be, well, our receipts are going to be higher than the other stuff. Both of them were total BS, Carl. I mean, as long as you keep lying to yourself.
Chief, all right, so the other BS is the Friedman nonsense, which we now know was BS, that NAFTA was going to cause a tectonic shift in the Mexican economy and therefore was going to be either neutral or positive to the American public. Okay? It was no such thing.
In theory, by the way,
You could put all the theory you want. The fact is that the Mexican government did not end up being a bastion on the hill like America, which is what was predicted.
Those guys, and by the way, I know those guys. I mean, on a personal, I did. They're all dead. On a personal level, they had the view, and you're right. One of the things, I can name you two or three things I thought that was totally misguided over time that Friedman taught, but now his basic stuff, his history of money and how money affects things, is as sacred today as it was then.
Oh yeah,
but here's where those guys went, Carl. Everybody, you do too. I mean, I'm not accusing you of anything. You do maybe a little less than most. Everybody, no matter what you do, when you look at the world, you look at it through your eyes.
Well, of course.
And your own. And Milton Friedman is a guy like 35, 40, 50 years ago, which is really when this was. Your experience has been basically the Anglo-American experience.
Yeah.
and you sit there and say, okay, you had a bunch of serfs and you had a bunch of nobles, and they had this kind of a deal because they had the world's worst deal economically. Then there was the Magna Carta, and then there was something else. And over time, people somehow, even though some of them lost their lives and whatever during the thing, eventually made it okay. I mean, there were unions in the coal mines, and eventually people got their piece of the stuff. This is the American way. I mean, it's the English way. I mean, I'm not saying everything's perfect here. I mean, we eventually got rid of slavery. We had to fight a war to do it, but we did it. I mean, there's always been this improvement along the way. So Milton Friedman applied that to Mexico and, to a certain extent, Chile, which got him thrown out of University of Chicago.
Right.
And because I was there when it happened, and or maybe it was a couple years after I left, and China. His view was, okay, if we get a couple of businesses going down in Mexico and people are making $3 an hour, and all of a sudden they're actually worth $7 or $8 an hour because they're producing the Chevy pickup trucks down there, that somewhere along the line they're going to demand 5 and 6, and the 6 is going to become 7. And oh, by the way, now all of a sudden there's places around that plant where people have bars and restaurants and supplies, and people are buying their blue jeans and whatever else they use for work. This is all going to happen. And by the way, the key, the linchpin was this economic growth would be stronger than oppressive government. And that's where the failure comes in. That exactly right there.
Well, exactly.
And because now they're still making $3 an hour, and guess what? The gangs are getting all the money, or somebody's getting all the dough. Or in China, the guys who work for the government get all the dough instead of these people getting a raise.
And you know what? And here's the
but they were wrong, but they weren't. People get to be wrong. They weren't misguided. They weren't crooked about it. That's what they actually felt.
Chief, I'm not saying he was a crook.
No, I know you're not, but I'm saying
you and I can
be wrong a lot. We are, but at least change gears when we see it.
Well, hello, if you don't do that and you're a traitor, you're very shortly broke.
Yeah.
Right. So, and then you're not a traitor anymore. So, I mean, you may back away from things, you may have a conviction, but when you're incorrect, you have to either step away from the market or take the other side. Those are the only options you got, all right?
Right.
Otherwise, you're not going to have any money. So the thing is, though, what I look at through all of this in the present tense is that you can sit here and you can play the yelling game, okay? Which Janet has. You want to talk about everything that's wrong with Treasury secretaries? By the way, just in case anybody thinks I'm picking on her because she's a woman, let me point out that Geithner was worse. All right.
Geithner didn't get $7 million from the firm she's supposed to be managing between jobs.
Well, but Geithner was the instrument of the illegality of what was being traded in front of the crash, okay? And he was the one who supported and
It was before his time, wasn't it?
No, I'm talking about all of the MBS that were...
What just happened when he was the head of the Federal Reserve in New York?
In New York, this was when Bernanke originally started buying this stuff up.
Right. So he was Bernanke's right-hand guy. Is it? I mean,
Running the Fed desk in New York, okay? And on the face of every one of those securities, and I wrote an article at the time, it was part of the reason I got to read Irvine in my reporting on this, on the face of those securities was the explicit statement that they had no backing by the federal government whatsoever, the Fannie and Fred paper. Not true for Ginnies. Ginnies are explicitly backed. But on the face of every one of those debt securities was the clear statement that these securities carried no backstop, guarantee.
But everybody...
I get that, Chief, but here's the thing. The Federal Reserve, by law, is prohibited from buying anything that doesn't have a federal backstop.
This is how confused this gets, and we're not arguing. There's a thing in municipal stuff. Chicago, City of Chicago had no obligation to essentially pay the Chicago Skyway bonds when they came due. Because they had the name Chicago on it.
They did.
And... but now what you're talking about?
Well, there's all right now.
But there were strings. You do. I know you know this. If the The only thing, in this country, we do have rules that sometimes are better than other countries, and one of them is that for banks, stock in companies is not good collateral.
Correct.
Where in Japan and in Europe it is, and look how
it is, and therefore the Japan Central Bank has been buying stocks.
Right. Well, not the central, but I mean the banks own stocks. So when the market crashed,
actually the JGB's been buying index.
Well, I'm talking about that's what made those banks zombie banks 30 years ago. They owned all the stocks in the company when the market went from 35,000 to 5 that wherever it went down to. What I'm saying. The only thing that was considered good collateral for these banks, and this buried a lot of these banks, were Fetty and Franny preferred. I don't know if you knew that or not. I think you probably did.
So I'm saying,
so in one sense, they're saying, "Don't worry, we're not gonna back this stuff." On the other hand, they're telling people, "Don't worry, we'll make sure it never happens," which is sort of the same thing.
Chief, I understand that. Okay, but this. The problem here is that everybody always looks for an excuse when the music begins to falter. Okay? You got everybody in a room. There's smoke coming from the corner over by the curtains, and that's a wee door. Right?
Yeah.
And everybody always... And then, historically... You know, this has always been, well, you know, we can take care of blah. I mean, you know, it goes all the way back to LTCM and the SNL stuff. It's not a new phenomenon. And we have taken two different approaches to this historically. One time in American history, the federal government, the Treasury, and the Fed... told every, which was a nascent thing at the time, because, you know, the Federal Reserve had only been around for, you know, about 10 years at that point. 1920-21, both told the bankers and Wall Street to go stick it up their behinds. And you made it, you own all the pieces, okay?
It rarely happens because usually it affects other people too.
Well, and it did.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Okay, it was an insanely deflationary crash.
Oh,
it
yeah.
was horrid.
Well, we got to dash off the break. I have a question for you over break, even though you can probably give me the answer in a second. If people didn't have the piggy move-up rule on the taxes, now that's, I should explain that better. If I bought NVIDIA, what did it come out at? $10, I don't know. What did it say it came out at $10? I have no idea. If I bought NVIDIA back then, and had 1,000 shares, but it's not worth God knows how much. And I croak, I'm sure everybody will one of these days, including me, and I left it to my kids, my grandkids, if I had any. They don't have to pay capital gains tax ever.
Right, they get a stepped up basis.
Right, so now right. My question is, the lady who bought into Mark Cuban's firm, essentially buying everybody out, outbidding everybody, assuming there were other people bidding, there may not have been, if she would have had to pay taxes like everybody else, I'm not.
In other
I'm,
words, if you got the basis of the progeny of the original purchase, not a step down.
Right, and she would have had to pay whatever the capital gains tax is, 21%. I'm going to say that her bid for Mark Cuban's team was 20% less. That this stuff affects everybody else when you give this kind of a benefit to some
absolutely.
People.
Absolutely. By the way. Right when we come back, I want to talk about this this Coloma nuke plant because you spurred me to actually look at it and you asked me a question and I'm going to answer it for you.
That's not a bad idea. Me actually remembering what I asked you. Hey, we're down 105 points. We've turned 150 since we walked in here in the NASDAQ. S&P is down 21, so I don't think we're going to do a turn like on Wednesday, but who knows? Market's kind of goofy. We'll be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
Individuals and businesses with tax problems, listen carefully. Do you feel like you're losing control of your finances? If you owe over $10,000 in back taxes or have unfiled tax returns, we can help you take back control. The IRS is the largest and most aggressive collection agency in the world, and they can seize your bank accounts, garnish your paycheck, close your business, and file criminal charges. Take control of your tax problem now by calling the experts at U.S. Tax Shield and take advantage advantage of the Fresh Start program and new laws that allow us to negotiate a settlement for the lowest amount possible. Our Better Business Bureau A-rated team of tax attorneys and enrolled agents can stop collections and get you protected so you can take control of your financial future. Call now for a free case review and a low price guaranteed quote to get you protected today. Call now. 800-388-4901. That's 800-388-4901. U.S. Tax Shield. 800-388-4901.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm out. Ricardo on the board doing a good job. SP Futures down 22. Ricardo, are you selling futures over there? What are you doing? NASDAQ futures down 107. Between breaks, Ricardo's selling spoos over there.
That's right, man.
He's up 150 at his spoos during the show. He's a happy camper. He's buying breakfast. He says, you know, we'll see. Over in Asia, we've got the Nikkei up 193.6%. Hang Seng up 198.17 above 17,090. So progress there. Shanghai, however, not so much. Down 7, it's 0.3%, 28.62. They had a bad CPI number over there. I don't know what this Chinese CPI even means, but anyway, they had a bad one. DAX, which was up pretty good earlier, now is only up 10 points, 0.1%. FTSE up 25.3. CAC around up 19.3. They were up probably double that the last time we did this. Yesterday, huge rally, huge. Dow up 683, it's 1.7%. S&P up 119, 2.3. NASDAQ up 464, 2.8. My screen was a wash in green. Every NASDAQ stock is to the moon, Alice. 10-year, down 6 basis points, 3.93. Made it back to 4% yesterday, which after being down to 3.7. So it's been very volatile. The Bund down 4 basis points, 2.22. Japan unchanged, 0.84. Oil, it's up a little bit, but it's still kind of in the lower bottom of this range. Up 39 cents, 76.58. Brent up 33 cents, 79.49. Natural gas up a penny, 214. RBOB unchanged, 239. Gold, which had a big rally yesterday, not so much of a rally today, went up $1.60, 24.64. Again, this is the December future. Silver down 8 cents, 27.52. It had a big rally yesterday. Copper up 7 cents, 403. Finally back over $4. FX, we're 109 against the euro, 127 against the pound. So not much change there. The one that's been changing has been the Japanese yen, up to 146. Again, it was 163 when it was real low. Got to 143 and a huge rally. Now it's 146.50. Crypto last up 660, was up more than that earlier. 60,351. So these guys traded less than 50 on Monday morning, and now they're back up to 60. So real volatile there as well. Anything that is affected by the Fed is very volatile this week. Carter, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
Morning, Chief. It's currently 7:37 a.m. here in Chicago. 63 degrees right now with a high of 75, breezy, and not as warm with sunshine and some clouds. This is kind of fall weather right now. It's very nice.
Very nice.
Tonight isn't it? Will be breezy, otherwise clear to partly cloudy. Low of 59 degrees. Order Phoenix, Arizona, 89 degrees right now with a high of 108. Same old, partly sunny and very, very warm. Tonight will be partly cloudy and, of course, very warm with a low of 90 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, inbound Kennedy from Monroe's, 20 minutes. Inbound Eden from Lane Cook, 36 minutes. We're looking at 21 minutes. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th, 16 minutes. And Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan, 27 minutes. Lastly, sports. Yesterday, the Diamondbacks lose to the Phillies, 4-6. And today we got a couple of games in the MLB. Crosstown Classic in Chicago. White Sox play the Cubs at 7:10 p.m. And the Diamondbacks play the Phillies again at 8:40 p.m. Lastly, the 2024 Summer Olympics are in session. The medal tracker says that the U.S. is winning. It's in first place with 103 medals. Second place is China with 73. And third place is France with 54 medals. That's all I got for you, Chief.
Yeah, hey, Carl, would you mind for a second if I read this one paragraph here out of my book here since I'm crazed with it.
Uh-oh.
And it kind of ties together some of the politics and everything else and some of the attitudes of people. And don't. I'm not saying you're like Henry Ford here, but just bear with me here. And then we'll talk about the nuclear plant, which is really positive news, I think. Between 1929 and 19, plus it tells people what happens when bad stuff happens. Between 1929 and 1932, employers slashed factory wages from $12 billion to $7 billion. That's a lot. The average weekly wage dropped from $25.03 to $16.73. Unemployment reached 6 million by the end of 1930, kept climbing until a staggering 12.8 million workers, 25% of the total labor force, were jobless in the spring of 1933. Someone compared the heartbreaking unemployment figures in the industrial cities of the North to the British casualty list at the Somme. So awesome as to become, in the end, meaningless, for the sheer statistics numb the mind. 1 million people out of work in New York. 1 million. 50% of the Cleveland labor force, 80% out of work in Toledo, 600,000 unemployed in Chicago, where Al Capone financed a soup kitchen that provided 120,000 free meals to the jobless in the space of just 6 weeks. Here's one for you, Carl. Not comparing you. Henry Ford, on the other hand, pompously proclaimed that the impression was a wholesome thing in general. It's a good thing recovery is prolonged, Ford said. Otherwise, the people wouldn't profit by the illness, and suggested that since half the people in Detroit were looking for work, they should go back to the farm and live off the land. Now, that was good advice. F. Scott Fitzgerald, who was appalled by the human tragedy encountered on his return to New York, began reading the works of Karl Marx. To bring on the revolution, it may be necessary to work inside the Communist Party. When people screw up to enough where something like that happens, you can mess everything up, Carl. That's why you and I are always adamant that we don't want people to screw things up. Because it's, what is it, cry havoc and let loose the dogs of war. When bad stuff happens, you never know where it's going to land.
Come alone to ding dong.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about something positive, the nuclear plant.
Yeah. Well, okay. So the Sierra Club is screaming about it, which right good. There tells you good. That it's a good thing.
Yep.
Right. All right, so that plant is a PWR. There are two common designs used in the United States for commercial power production. BWR, boiling water reactor, which does not have a secondary loop, so the actual cooling water that is used to keep the plant stable goes through the turbines. And it becomes activated. It's not radioactive, but it's activated because the hydrogen and oxygen are exposed to very high levels of radiation. They become excited. So when you shut one of those down, it's some number of hours before that bleeds off and you can go in the turbine room. And there's actually shielding around the turbine room for that reason. It's a labyrinthine pattern, so you can't just like walk in there, okay? Because you'd get cooked. A PWR never boils the water inside the pressure vessel. It instead keeps it under extremely high pressure. It circulates, goes through a heat exchanger. The heat exchanger has lower pressure on the secondary side. That boils, produces the steam, and drives the turbines. Okay, so there is physical isolation between the cooling water.
Does that mean it's better or just different?
It's a different design. There are differences in the way they operate. A BWR, because the water actually boils inside the reactor vessel, has a negative temperature coefficient as a part of its design, which is a significant safety factor in terms of how you design the control rods and the layout of the core. Because water is a moderator, it slows the neutrons down from the reaction, makes it more likely that the neutron that comes off one fission will hit another atom and cause another one. Okay, so as you get void spaces from the boiling, the moderation capability is reduced. This is a negative stabilizing influence on the reaction. That's a good thing. All right, PWR does not do that, and so now you rely on the design of the core for that, along with of course always the control rods, which set the power level. The reason the plant was shut down early. It was scheduled to go down for refueling at the end of its last cycle, and then it was going to be turned off. It was shut down early in advance of that because there was a problem with the control rod actuators. Now, I haven't been able to figure out exactly what was wrong with them, but they had an issue with that. That is a serious safety factor. You cannot continue.
Has that same thing happened to Zion?
No.
We'll talk about Zion next week. Keep going. Sorry.
Yeah, they had some problems with the control rod actuators at this plant. They had to take it offline to fix that. They were far enough through the fuel cycle on the current load when it happened that it didn't make any sense to shut it down, let it cool down, fix it, and then bring it back online for the remainder of that fuel load. Okay. As a result, it was turned off earlier than it was normally going to be turned off. The reason they were going to shut it down originally was because the cost of the power that it produced was higher than the alternatives at that time. All right. So, well, you know, hey, that's the way, that's called an economy.
Do they
right?
still have all the spent stuff sitting on their property there like they do in the, like in Zion?
Oh, they do everywhere else, yeah.
Okay.
Now, the thing about shutting a power reactor down that a lot of people don't understand is that about 10% of the output isn't actually coming from active fission. It's coming from the decay heat of the waste products that are in the reactor core. This is why Fukushima happened, because they lost coolant, and if you can't get that heat out of the reactor, it melts, okay? So the reality of it is you can't just turn it off, take top off it, fix it, do whatever, or change the fuel. You have to shut it off, maintain the coolant flow for a period of time until that 10% decays enough that the pressure has come down to the point that you can uncap it, all right? And that takes quite a while. It's you know, it's several weeks.
Well, it's weeks or months. It's not years of it.
No, but it's you can't just turn it off and say, okay, it's off, okay? It doesn't work like that because okay. That decay heat, it decays exponentially, the output that it produces, but it's a period of time and a fairly, I mean, you're talking about a couple of, you know, 2-4 weeks before you can start to, you know, get to a place where you can reduce the power, and it's probably a month before you can take the cap off the thing. And because until you can have cooling that has the water in the vessel by circulating that's under the boiling point, you can't take the cover off of it, okay, because it's too hot. It'll flash boil and explode. So you have to cool it down to that point. It takes time. They decided that it made no economic sense to do that. They sold the reactor off to another company, the entire plant. The reason they're able to restart it is that firm envisioned the very reasonable possibility that there would be a restart. And so they kept the maintenance up on all the other stuff. I mean, if you think about a nuclear plant, it's like any other large industrial plant. If you just turn it off and abandon it, everything starts to rot.
Oh, right? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, they kept the maintenance up on all the other stuff.
Which has to cost a fortune.
Well, it wasn't cheap, but they did that. And so this plant is reasonably restartable at a rational economic cost to do so, because the refurbishment is really a function of taking the cap off of it, putting a new fuel load in it, and, you know, and going through the normal certification stuff. Okay, is everything working correctly as we slowly, you know, come back online? You bring everything back up heat-wise, you know, heat level and everything on a slow basis to make sure that everything's all right. And then, you know, then you regain criticality.
How big is it? How many houses are we talking about? It's pretty big, right?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about a very large, I mean, it's, you know, it's like any other industrial plant. If you take an oil refinery and you actually shut it down cold, you can't just turn it back on in 3 days.
But, I mean, in terms of, is it, Commonwealth Edison still has a few plants here. There's one out in Braidwood and stuff. Is it bigger than those or the same size or on a scale of 1 to 10, where is it?
Well, it's single reactor, and if I remember correctly, the nameplate rating is like 900 megawatts. So it's an average size reactor for commercial power. But there's only one unit there. Now, most of your nuclear plants, they'll have, you know, 2, 3, 4 because they already did the, you know, the review for the siting. But there is a practical limit on the size of a power reactor core, and it's in the gigawatt area. So
they mentioned they were going to do something different with are those the kind of reactors you're talking about? The little ones around it? They got room there to do those? They
no,
got the
those
wires
are, those are SMRs are a different small modulars are a different sort of design. But most of those are PWRs. So, yeah, I mean, the basic technology is the same, but they're much smaller. The idea behind those is that they are not serviced or refurbished in place. They run for 5 or 10 years, and then they're transported whole, basically, you know, a piece, to a centralized location where refueling and refurbishment is done.
How the hell do you transfer that thing? How big is it?
Well, the little ones that they're talking about, the little SMRs, actually are truck trailer size for the actual core.
Well, you plug them on a truck trailer or a railroad car?
Yeah, I mean they're transfer. That's the whole concept behind them, is that I don't know that some of this stuff's pipe dream. All right, I mean, is the theory behind it valid? Well, yeah, it is. Let's see them commercially deployed and how the numbers all work out. I'm not so sure that this works, as people think it will.
God, how many police cars you got to have around that thing going down the highway?
Well, the containment and the shielding, the way they're designed is, you could crash a plane into them and you wouldn't go through it. Okay.
Okay.
So, I mean, would they be badly damaged by, that kind of accident? Yes, they would. But would it, would it breach and end up releasing, regular radionucleotides into the environment? No. They're designed for that kind of situation. And that's one of the reasons that people, are thinking this is a way forward for nuclear power, and that you can put them in those kinds of places. The biggest issue you have with conventional plants, conventional nuclear plants, and one of the reasons I like the molten salt designs is it solves this problem, is that conventional plants that use water as a moderator and a primary coolant are limited to the triple point of water, where you cannot, the critical point. Water above a certain temperature is not a liquid anymore, no matter how much pressure it's under. Okay. And as a result, this leads to a serious issue in that the efficiency of a heat engine, the maximum thermodynamic efficiency, is the difference in Kelvin between the heated working fluid and the cooled working fluid that goes back in. And that's the best you can ever do. That's physics. There's nothing you can do.
Well, it's like an air conditioner, right?
Well, yeah, sort of. And so basically what this means is that power reactors that use water as a primary coolant, are limited to about 35% thermal efficiency. The rest of the energy that you generate gets thrown away, which is why they have to be put on large bodies of water like lakes and, huge rivers and oceans.
It's really cool. There's one in the south. Is it Braidwood, southwest of the city? It's kind of cool. We were driving around down there because her cousin had his auto place. And somehow or another, we're driving around. It had to be like 5 below 0. And it was snow all over the place. And the steam coming up. It was. If you were Phil Fotag, there was a lot of neat pictures. The steam coming off the thing.
Oh, yeah. But this is one of the things. This is the reason I like the molten salt designs. Beyond the fuel economy and the ability to burn up the waste products on a more more expeditious basis, if you will, is that they break that barrier because you don't they run at much higher temperatures, and what that means
are any of these around?
No, well, we proved they work at Oak Ridge, and then we went a different direction because they don't produce. That fuel cycle is not conducive to being used as part of a nuclear weapons program.
Ah.
Okay, so for political reasons, we decided this wasn't. But the advantage they have is that you could get into the 50 to 60% thermal efficiency area with them, which is, there's engineering.
Do we have
challenges?
If we decided, I want to talk more a little bit here about your take on what's going on with these currencies. But if we decided, okay, tomorrow, the two of us bumps land in the Oval Office, and we want to start this up. Where the hell do we go find 200 people out of what school to start building one of these things and designing them?
Or we haven't. I mean, all the stuff that we learned from the MSR experiment down in Oak Ridge is, there's engineering work to be done to commercialize it that was not done. Okay, basically the reactor was run to prove that what they thought would work. It did. Okay. But the engineering work to commercialize that has not been done. That would require, that. But the bigger challenge is that you have these guys like the Sierra Club, that their intent is that we all live like cavemen. Of course, they never volunteer to go first.
No.
Okay.
Oh, no.
No, you can't have petroleum. Okay, well, then you go ahead and you not have it. Well, that means you have no electricity because there's no insulation on the wire. You go down the
list. I'm going to jump in my private plane to go tell everybody to turn off their lawnmower.
Right, exactly. All right, and so, you know, we have to, as a matter of public policy, we need to neuter these people, and there may be...
I'll push back a little on that in the sense that because I actually want to get in this currency stuff, but when we built the pipeline, it's something that's long past. We don't even want to argue about it anymore. They built the pipeline in Canada, and all kinds of people said, you know, what about the elk? What about the rattlesnake? What about God knows what?
Right.
And eventually, it was a big fight, and the pipeline was built, and it was built, I think, very successfully in just about everybody's thoughts. I mean, I don't know if anybody says it isn't, except they probably should have put a natural gas one next to it, except for the fact that nobody knew how to liquefy natural gas back then. But the design built was way more accommodating to animal safety and everything else than the original one. So the guys that bitched and moaned, I think, actually served a purpose and did some good, Carl. I mean,
Chief, I'm not arguing that.
If the Sierra Club makes people make absolutely sure the damn thing's safe while they're bitching, you know what, I'm all for it.
but everything has a cost.
Yeah.
Okay. And we need to stop pretending that you can have these things without that cost.
Oh, without a doubt.
And the people who want to scream the loudest are the ones who ought to eat the cost first.
Well, I don't disagree. All right. Shift gears. FX.
Yep.
I keep talking about the poor people in Mexico. The Mexican peso, they used to devalue the thing on purpose so the rich people made money instead of the other people. But for we're talking about in today's world, and I'm not insulting anybody, you're talking about the euro, you're talking about the dollar, you're talking about the Swiss franc, just because they're stable, you're talking about the British pound, and you're talking about the Japanese yen.
Right.
Now, of course, you've got the Saudis and you got the Chinese ones. They're all in there somewhere. But I don't think I've ever seen, in the last, you and I have been doing this show for forever together, I think both of us agree, and I can list a few things we agree, that there's been an amazing central bank coordination, whether we like what they did or not, in the last 10, 15 years regarding inflating everybody's currency, essentially favoring fixed income, favoring whatever, fixed asset owners versus renters, those kinds of things. Whether they knew those were the outcomes or not, they did it. But they've been amazingly, now you and I talked, God, Crowd had to be 4 or 5 months ago, we both sensed a slight, shall we say, rumbling in the force regarding these guys coordinating as much as they were before. It didn't seem like they were as together going forward, I'll say a year ago or 2 years ago. This thing with the Japanese, I don't think I've ever seen anything like this at a level of these currencies. I mean, I had a seminar with the people in Mexico were here, and the peso was devalued the week while they were here, so we were talking about it. So I have experience in regarding those kinds, without insulting Mexico, those kinds of currencies. I've never seen one like this yen move like it has in the last 2 weeks in peacetime.
The yen move, which, you know, was a little tectonic earthquake that set off the flash crash, if you will, a few days ago. Very similar to what happened in the early part of 2007, except there it was centered in China. And that was what made my ears perk up and start writing my column, because I saw that crash happen over there.
Nobody can borrow there. You and I could borrow in Japan.
Well, I understand that. Okay, now the reason it translated over here so badly and rapidly is the yen carry trade phenomenon. Right. And it, you know, and as we talked about a little bit earlier in the week on Tuesday, as I was explaining to a friend of mine, you think this exchange rate thing is stable. This looks like a free lunch. The problem is, of course, that you're ignoring the risk that no, exchange rates are not stable necessarily, and you can get into the keister if you're wrong on that.
Well, they can be compared to a stock. They're quote stable, but you're your margin is so much smaller and your leverage is so much bigger that it makes it worse.
And after you put 10 times the crank on, It's, you know, the little move destroys you.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. So this is the thing about this. But what Japan is facing right now is what we're going to face in another 10 or 20 years. And Japan has tried to paper it over and ignore it. And they are now, they have their back against the wall. Their young people have refused to produce children since the Nikkei dislocation and the Kuroda scheme, if you will, which is not entirely just him. It's also all, you know, his predecessors and you know, whatever, that we're going to buy everything. We're going to stabilize the currency. We're going to stabilize the stock market. We're gonna, you know, well, okay, the Nikkei has not gone back to where it was before the blow up, number one. But the young people stopped making babies. And the problem with this is you have the same kind of social program and issuance over there, not to the degree we have in the United States, but you have it, and you've got a future in which their working age population is going down. Now, at some point, your tax receipts exceed the coupon payments. Well, the way that Japan has resolved this is we'll just make the interest rate zero forever. There won't be any interest payments.
We'll just keep buying the stuff up.
Yeah, and you know, this sounds great, except the exponential expansion of what you've done, it continues apace.
We got to dash it. Let's continue this on Tuesday. But you're so right, Carl. By the way, I think the Japanese market did exceed their old record recently here, but Carl is absolutely correct. It was the highest close was 38,915. In October of 1989.
Yeah.
That's how long it took. And they got down as low as...
30 years, Chief.
Yeah, they got down as low as 8,100 from 35,000. That's... this is with the government buying stocks.
Chief, we are facing the same sort of dislocation. The only difference is we didn't push it as far as Japan, so if we take it in the keister and we actually accept what has to happen and let it, it won't be as bad. But it's still going to be bad.
All right, put Carl's brain to work for one final question. If we get some kind of a correction that in some ways, I guess money-wise and other ways, God, I don't want to sound like Henry Ford when I just read his stuff, for it to be not, I won't say it's healthy because we got clients that it won't be healthy for, but if how far down can we go? If we went down 15, 20%, would it solve most of the, quote, problems of this?
No.
And can we go down a number at which the dislocation won't be so bad? I guess is my question.
No.
Well, I mean, we don't want 20% unemployment. That's not going to help anybody.
It won't stay there. But you have to. Here's the thing: if you don't focus it in the right place, if you don't focus a correction in the right place, in other words, if you don't take out the medical monopolists and literally take them out behind the woodshed,
yeah.
If you don't solve that problem, you haven't fixed anything. All you've done is had a crash. And then more bubble, okay? But you got to fix that.
Let's kick that one around. You know what? Every time, every day now, even when you're not here, I talk about that's being the single biggest. Every drug now is $1,000. Seems like
it's got, Chief. It's got. We can have 90% of the medical care that people need for an 80% reduction in what's spent on it. Now, that's not going to make some people happy. There are going to be some people who don't get what they want.
Well,
but if we don't do that,
these chemotherapies that are $2,000 to $3,000, they could just easily be $800. And it might, you know what, if one actually does work, and we got to send you and your family down to the Amazon and wrestle an alligator and pull out his wisdom tooth to get the piece, then I'll pay $20,000 for it. But until that happens, if it costs somebody $10 to make it, I don't want to pay $20,000 for it.
Well, you know, yeah, it's and there's much more than that because. Most of what is sold as medicine today is really, A, doesn't work, and B, what it does is take all your money.
Oh, I know. S&P futures down 21, NASDAQ futures down 116. We've had a turnaround here during the show. I don't think it's because they're listening to us.
It's just flattened.
It's flattened out, but I mean, we were up 60. We came in. It's 160 point turn in the NASDAQ used to be something, Carl. It's not anymore. I get you.
Know what? But there's no real volatility. Everything's a stable store of value.
2-3% a year. Did we go? I sat here for what? 3-4 years in the when was Obama in office? Not because it was him, We didn't have a 1% move in the market in what? How many trading days? 400 or 300 or something?
Oh, I know. It was like over a year, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, back on Monday, Stocks and Jacks. Carl, have a nice weekend. Talk to you on Tuesday, right?
Tuesday morning.
Yep. Have a nice weekend, everybody. Nice job, Ricardo.
That's all, folks.